What I want to talk about today is topological groups and their action. Okay, so a topological group is a group with a topology, right? Okay, something like this, where G dot is a group, G T is a topological space, and the operation and inverse are continuous. And sometimes it's required to be Hausdorff, but that doesn't matter because I'm only concerned with Polish groups, which just means the topological space is Polish, and they are, of course, necessarily Hausdorff. Okay, so some examples of Polish groups in a moment. Let me just make a remark to start with. There's a branch of mathematics called topological groups. There's a lot of books written with the title like topological groups. Now, if you take out one of those books and look at it on approximately page 2, it's going to say, from now on, we consider only locally compact groups. Okay. I myself am mostly interested in groups which are not locally compact. Well, some of these are locally compact. So a locally compact group is Polish if and only if it's second countable. And you're more likely to see it referred to as second countable locally compact rather than as Polish locally compact. Maybe some other names. But anyway, the subject known as topological groups is about locally compact groups. And most of the theorems that I talk about are either trivial or meaningless, well known for locally compact. There's recently been an interest in more general Polish groups that are not locally compact, and this comes from several sources, including logic, operator algebras, ergodic theory, unitary group representation theory, and various other subjects. You'll hear some about it at the workshop next week, I think. Okay, well, the point I want to make, or two points I want to make. First, since I'm not talking about locally compact groups, the subject matter of this course is really not a part of the branch of mathematics called topological groups and has very little in common with it. And secondly, all those books on topological groups are worthless as far as this course is concerned. Okay, so we got some Polish topological group G. We'll usually call that capital G or something like that, and elements G, and we'll write them multiplicatively. And E will be the group identity. Okay, now an action of G on X, X is some set. Well, there are two definitions. The one you usually find in algebra books is a homomorphism from G into the group of permutations of X. Okay, but that's the same thing as, and also is, a function A where AGX is written G dot X. This is an element of G and an element of X. That dot function is the element here, such that two things happen. First, E dot X equals X for all X, of course. And secondly, G dot H dot X is the group element GH dotted with X. And now if you think about it, if it satisfies these rules, when you look at a fixed G, that's a permutation of X, and vice versa. So these are the same thing. They're an action, okay? And now the advantage of writing it like this is if X is a topological space, well, we have continuous actions and Borel actions, etc. So that'll always mean it's a function of two variables. Okay, another terminology that's frequently used is a G-space. A G-space is an action of G. So the G-space and action are essentially synonyms. But we sometimes talk about a Polish G-space. Okay, remember all groups now forever are Polish. Okay, a Polish G-space means X is Polish and A is continuous. Or a Borel G-space, X is Polish or equivalently a Borel set in a Polish space. Equivalent, because we can make a Borel set Polish by changing the topologist, and A is a Borel measurable function. So that's the sort of thing we're going to want to talk about. Okay, now, given this kind of action, or G space, we have what's known as the orbit equivalence relation. On X, well, X is equivalent, I'll write it E sub A, to Y if and only if there exists a G such that G dot X equals Y, and the equivalence classes are orbits. And well, we talked about equivalence relations last week, and I'll have some more to say about it now, but there's more to an action than just an equivalence relation. As two different actions could very well give you the same equivalence relation. In fact, a lot of actions are transitive, meaning there's only one equivalence class. So as an equivalence relation, it's not terribly interesting, but as an action, it may be something that can be said. Okay, so the first topic now is examples. Examples of Polish groups and actions, and we'll start with the locally compact case to see what it is we're generalizing. Okay, so the first example, G is the group of rotations of the plane. But the origin, well, topologically, that's a circle, certainly compact. And G acts on R2 in the obvious way. Okay, if phi xy is xy rotated by phi about the origin. So two things are in the same orbit if they're in a same distance from the origin. Here's the orbit equivalence relation, a bunch of concentric circles. There's this one point orbit at the origin, a bunch of circles. In this place, the orbits look, in this case, the orbits look like astronomical orbits. That's not always the case. That may be the source of the word, I'm not sure. Okay, well, second example, countable discrete groups are Polish and locally compact. Third example, the reals under addition, what I want to do third, a Okay, now, we frequently think of real numbers, think of this group thought of as time. So, in other words, when something changes with time, something like X changes with time, that what that really means is that this group acts on X, whatever something is. I mean, maybe it's 10 particles in a box and each has three position and velocity coordinates, so X is R60 and it's changing with time. So this thing acts on R60. Now I have to explain the word dynamics, which is in the title of this class. It has two different meanings. One meaning, well, just something is changing with time, as opposed to statics, where it's not changing with time. And that's one meaning of the word dynamics, changing with time, which means you're looking at actions of this group. In fact, that's what almost everybody other than a pure mathematician would mean by the subject. But here's another meaning. It's more general, just actions of any group, not just the reals. And if it's, say, R2 or something, we can't think of it really as time. But sometimes the word dynamics is used in this more general meaning, the actions of any old group, and whoever came up with the title of this course is using the word dynamics in that more general sense. Okay, well, here's another group, Rn plus, which is locally compact. Up to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. GLNC is the group of n by n non-singular matrices with complex entries. Okay, well, that's a subset of C to the n squared. It's an open subset, therefore Polish, and it's easy to see that the group operation and the inverse are continuous. So this is a Polish topological group. Proposition, a closed subgroup of a Polish or locally compact group is a Polish okay, so here's another example of an action. This is, well, actually, in this case, it doesn't have to be locally compact, but suppose, let's say H is a Polish group, not necessarily locally compact, G, a closed subgroup, then G acts on H in several ways, by left multiplication, G dot H is GH, or by right multiplication, G dot H is HG inverse. And it's easy to check what the orbits are. The orbits are cosets. So they're all closed. We put them together. Is there a mistake? Okay, we can have that X by conjugation, G dot H is G H G inverse, And here the equivalence relation is sometimes very complicated. There's certainly no reason why they have to be closed equivalence classes. Okay, well now let's consider closed subgroups. Of the groups of matrices. As every schoolboy knows, this is a closed subgroup of the 2x2 matrices. So that's one subgroup, but a more interesting subgroup is UN equals the unitary group, the group of unitary n by n matrices. Unitary means it preserves inner product when you multiply a vector, okay? As it's, when it's acting on the vector space. Okay, now UN acts on, well, let's say on this, or actually on all matrices, whether they're singular or not, by conjugation. Okay, and the equivalence relation is unitary equivalence of matrices or operators and this illustrates common phenomena. A lot of the equivalence relations of ordinary everyday mathematics are in fact the orbit equivalence relation of a Polish group acting on a Polish space, even if they're not necessarily presented in that manner. Now, all the examples I gave so far are continuous actions. I'm also interested in Borel actions that are not necessarily continuous. So let me give an example of one of those. Well, here's the easiest example I could think of. What are we up to? Seven, eight, six, seven, eight. Okay, Z2 acts on the reals by, well, 0 dot anything is itself, and 1 dot 0 is 0, and 1 dot r is 1 over r if r is not 0. And it takes the reciprocal of everything. It's easy to see that that's a Borel action. And it's also pretty obvious it's not continuous. So this is the kind of thing we're also interested in. Okay, now that's these examples are locally compact. Now let's consider the general case, non or not necessarily locally compact. So first of all, another proposition, a countable product of Polish finite or countable product of Polish groups is a Polish group. Now, by product, I mean the group structure is the direct product, not the direct sum, and the topology is the topological product. And this leads outside the class of locally compact groups. So we could take, for example, the product of countably many copies of Z2. This is the Cantor group. It's topologically the Cantor set, and this is compact. Well, in our first non-locally compact, we could have the reals to the omega, which I'll probably just write like this. Okay, well, this is non-locally compact, obviously. But it's certainly Polish and reasonable group. Okay, now let's take the analog of example 4. The analog of example four, which is now number two, is a separable Banach space. And here our group operation is addition, and we're talking about the norm topology. After all, those are separable Banach spaces, and a Banach space is finite dimensional. Excuse me, a Banach space is locally compact if and only if it's finite dimensional. So the other examples are not. Now let's consider the non-locally compact or higher dimensional analog of 7. So 3, let's H is an infinite dimensional separable Hilbert space. L will be the set of bounded linear operators from H to H. Okay, the infinite dimensional analog of matrices. U infinity will be a subset, the set of unitary operators and this is a group. Okay, so this is the infinite dimensional unitary group as you compose two operators. Okay. Now, what about topology? Well, our friends, the functional analysts, have come up with all sorts of different topologies on this set L. And they have creative names like the weak operator topology and the strong operator topology. Well, either of those will work. U infinity with the weak operator topology of a strong operator topology. Now, I don't mean that they're the same topology on all of L, but when you restrict down to the unitary group, they're the same topology. Is a Polish group, and it's not locally compact. It's something a little different. Okay, now again, U infinity, well, let's take the analog of this. U infinity acts on L by conjugation, and the equivalence relation is unitary equivalence of operators. Okay, now this is not quite in the context of that we're working in this course for the following reason. We're talking about actions of a Polish group on a Polish space, or maybe some decent subset of a Polish space. Now, the natural topologies on L, like the norm topology and so on, the operator topologies are not Polish. They're not separable. Right? So this is not a Polish G space in any natural way. But it is a Borel G space. Well, I'm not sure how natural this is, but it can be regarded as a Borel G space Okay, if we choose an orthonormal basis, then the operators are just infinite matrices. So we can think of them as a Borel set in C to the omega cross omega. And clearly the action is Borel. So is that a question? No. No, feel free to, especially if I make a mistake, feel free to check.
Now, the thing is that you're giving it a special topology that depends on the basis.
Yes.
But am I right in thinking the Borel structure?
Yes, you're correct. Oh, for some of you who didn't get the topology may depend on the basis, but so in other words, two different bases will give you different open sets, but not different Borel sets. So it's in some way as I didn't really talk about Borel spaces, so I didn't want to discuss it. But for those of you who know, this is kind of canonical as an action on Borel spaces. Okay, so that's the third example. Well, I hope this gives you at least some idea of why the operator algebra people might be interested in this subject. So my next example should indicate why logicians are interested, or why some logicians are interested. So where are we for? S infinity will be the group of permutations of omega. Now, there's two ways to look at the topology. We can take a basis. For B a bijection between finite subsets of omega. And we can talk about GB is, what do I want to say? NB is all elements, all permutations of omega which extend B. Okay, this is our basis for the topology as B ranges over arbitrary bijections. It's not hard to see that it's continuous, that the operations are continuous, and that it's homeomorphic to bare space. Another way to look at this is that S infinity is a G delta subspace of omega to the omega. Some functions from omega to the omega are permutations, some aren't. That's a G delta subspace, therefore Polish. Okay, now let's let L, no connection with the previous L. This is L is the language in the sense of model theory. So a language with one binary relation symbol. Okay, and we want our space, I want the space that this is going to be acting on to be countable L structures, countably infinite L structures. Well, we might as well think of the universe as being literally omega. So our space XL will be 2 to the omega cross omega, identifying an L structure with its characteristic, or identifying a binary relation with its characteristic function. So we think of X encodes the structure AX, which is omega RX where Rx holds of n of m n if and only if x of the pair m n equals 1. So this is the space of all structures, L structures on omega. Now, this group is acting on in such a way, so S infinity acts on XL so that the orbit equivalence relation is isomorphism. Well, when you take an element of the group that's a permutation of omega, you apply that to a structure, you're just renaming the elements, you get an isomorphic structure on omega, and vice versa, an isomorphism is just renaming the elements. So formally, formally, we have the logic action JL, S infinity cross XL into XL, given by JL GX equals Y, if and only if, for any M and N, Y M N is 1. If and only if X G inverse M G inverse N equals 1. And that's a continuous action by the group S infinity on the space. Now, there's nothing special about this particular language, so for any countable language, there is a logic action for L. Okay, a continuous action by S infinity on a space homeomorphic to the Cantor set. There's infinitely many languages. This example, in some sense, is sufficient. If you can understand this example, you'll probably understand every theorem, the meaning of every theorem and definition that I give. But let me give one more example anyway. Fifth example. K is compact. Well, compact Polish, compact metric. H of K is the group of homeomorphisms of K, which we can think of as a G delta subspace of the function space CKK, so it's Polish. And, well, that group and its subgroups act on K in the obvious way. And it may be transitive if K is homogeneous. It may not. Depends on what K is. Okay, of course, all the closed subgroups of HK are also Polish. And in some sense, we've got all of them then because of the following theorem of Luspensky. Finally get to a theorem. Every Polish group is topologically isomorphic to a closed subgroup of the group of homeomorphisms of the Hilbert cube we say, that's a universal group. Okay, enough examples. Any questions on examples before I go on? Some theorems. I'm going to start on groups, but I'll get to actions. So first we have the open mapping theorem, just like in Banach spaces, and in fact the same proof. Let me just say this way, if F is a continuous homomorphism, it is open. If F onto G2, then F is open. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Any Polish groups. Now, this has a consequence. Remember, back to the first day, I was talking about changing the topology. You've got a Polish space. You want to enlarge the topology, make more sets open. Well, that's fine on a space, but you can't do it on a Polish group. If you think of the same group with a larger topology, doesn't work. Okay, so there's really, there are no finer Polish topologies. On G, and in fact, a Polish group G, let me put it this way, a group G admits at most one Polish definable Polish topology. In other words, it's conceivable there may be a group with two different Polish topologies, but you need the axiom of choice to produce it. And that's entirely contrary to the spirit of descriptive set theory, so we don't want to think about it. There's no definable way to put two different Polish topologies on a group. Now, when I talk about metrics on a group, I will, of course, always mean metrics on a Polish group. I will always mean a metric compatible with the topology. That goes without saying. So, definition. A metric D on G is called left invariant. If the distance between GH1, GH2 is the distance between H1 and H2 for all GH1, H2 in the group. Theorem 4.3, theorem of Birkhoff and Kakatani, says that any Polish group, in fact any metrizable group, admits a left invariant metric and now obviously it also admits a different metric, which is right invariant. But they're two different metrics. It will not necessarily have one metric which is two-sided invariant, but some groups do, like abelian. So that's a special case we want to consider. A TSI group is one with a two-sided invariant metric. Okay, now a Polish group has a left invariant metric by this theorem, and it has a complete metric by definition of Polish, but again, they may not be the same. In general, they're not, but they might be, and that's another special case. A CLI group is one with a complete left invariant . Okay, now there's more than one left invariant metric, but it turns out that if No, a metric means metric compatible with a topology. Yeah, I certainly meant compatible with the topology. I was just too lazy to write it. Okay, now if D1 and D2 are left invariant, okay, a sequence is D1 Cauchy if and only if it is D2 Cauchy. They agree about Cauchy sequences, and they obviously agree about convergence, because that's a topological property, not a metric property. Okay, so we can talk about left Cauchy, meaning one or all left invariant. And similarly, whether it, if one left invariant metric is complete, then they're all complete. Okay, now let's look at some examples. First of all, if D is left invariant and D star GH is D G inverse H inverse, then D star is right invariant and vice versa. Now, I'll leave it to you to check if we just take the soup norm metric. In other words, this the standard function space metric. This is right invariant. More interesting is S infinity. Let's put the standard metric on omega to the omega. The distance between x and y is 1 over 1 plus the least n, such that x of n is not equal to y of n. Well, this is left invariant, as you can easily check. Okay, so what does left Cauchy mean here? Left Cauchy means convergent in omega to the omega. As it converges, or in fact, convergent to a 1-1, not necessarily onto function. Okay, so that's left Cauchy, and it's left convergent if what it converges to is actually a permutation. And ditto for subgroups. Okay, now since all left invariant metrics are the same as far as Cauchiness and convergence, it shows that S infinity is not CLI, And a subgroup, a closed subgroup, of S infinity is CLI if and only if it is closed in omega to the omega, which seems like hardly anything is going to be CLI. Okay, so that makes the class of CLI groups look very small. Now let me make it look large. Here's some diagrams. There are various types of Polish groups, and here's the inclusions between classes of Polish groups. Let's see, we have groups that are algebraically nice, like abelian, and then a little less nice would be nilpotent, and then solvable. So the meaning of that arrow is that the class on the left, or the line segment, is the class on the left is a subclass of the class on the right. And then we have those that are topologically small. We've got compact and countable discrete and compact groups are locally compact and so are discrete. And we have the TSI groups. Obviously, abelian groups have two-sided invariant. Discrete groups have two-sided invariant. Compact groups have two-sided invariant metrics. Locally compact and nilpotent do not, in general, have them. And here we got the CLI groups, which are bigger than all these things. Okay, and the new classes. Both classes are closed under, well, closed subgroups. Countable products. And continuous homomorphic images. So these two classes have all the closure properties that one might want. Now, let me give one more example of something that's out here, but nowhere to the left. If G is a Polish group, K is compact, then we get a new Polish group, which I will call CKG. Well, it's literally the function space. Okay, well, it's continuous functions from K to G. That gives us our topology and pointwise operations. Okay, so f, given two functions, okay, now it's easy to see that if G is Polish, this will be Polish. And if G is CLI, so is CKG. That's easy to check. But if G is not locally compact, this will not be locally compact unless K is finite. So this leaves out of the class of locally compact groups. So if you take G to be your favorite locally compact group and some K, this will give you a CLI group. So this is CLI and not anything else. This includes some of the groups that the physicists in are interested in, which is gauge groups, current groups. In the gauge groups, G is a Lie group, that is a locally compact group of physical symmetries. K is physical space. Now, some compact approximation to R3. And so that gives you a group that's in the CLI class, but nowhere else, nowhere to the left. Yes, yes. Well, if you start with a Polish topology, this will give you a. If you start with a Polish topology on G, this will give you. Okay, start with a metric giving a Polish topology. That will give a Polish group. Now, if it's complete left, if it's left. What? Now, if it's complete left invariant, then the new metric will also be left invariant.
Okay, will it depend which metric I take on G?
No, because there's only one topology on a Polish group.
Okay, right.
No, that's all right. Anything else before I stop talking about groups and start talking about actions? Well, I could spend the whole semester on groups, but I want to talk about actions. Okay, now actions, of course, give us an equivalence relation. So I've already talked a little about it last time, you know, equivalence relations. But there are also theorems about actions which are not directly related to the equivalence relation. Now, let me say there's more to the subject than just equivalence relations. So first topic, we'll go back to the glorious days of the first class, and we talked about changing the topologies. So here's corollary 1.5 from the first class. X is Polish, Y a subset of X. The following are equivalent. Y is Borel, and D, there is a Polish topology on X finer than the usual one, the Polish topology T on X finer than the usual one, with Y T open, or T closed, or T clopen, or whatever you want. Okay, now let's say we've got an action, and we take some Borel Y, okay, I can refine the topology to make Y Polish by this theorem, make Y open, okay, but there's a problem. When you change the topology, A may not be continuous. So the question is, can you change the refine the topology and keep A continuous? Well, if Y is totally arbitrary, certainly not. Well, not if Y is one point in an uncountable orbit, for example. Well, a point is certainly a Borel set. But if the action is continuous, the orbit is homogeneous, right? If I make one point open, every point in that orbit has got to be open. So certainly not for any old Borel set. But we do get an invariant version of this theorem. Where am I up to? Theorem 4.4. Okay, G, a Polish group, X, a Polish space, a continuous action. This is what I was calling a Polish G space. Okay, and let Y be Borel and A invariant, in other words, a set of orbits. Invariant means the same as it did last week for the orbit equivalence relation. Then there is a topology T on Y such that T is Polish, T is finer than the usual one, C, Y is T open, and D, yes, X, thank you. And what did I call the action? A is continuous with respect to T. A continuous is a function of two variables with respect to T and the one and only topology on G. Excuse me?
And you don't add new
Borel? No, well, that follows automatically that the Borel structure is the same because look at the identity function, the pre-image. Well, what am I saying? The only sets that can be made, this is another theorem from the first class, the only sets that can be made open in a finer topology are Borel sets and in the old topology. Okay, now, in general, that topology is not particularly pleasant to describe or natural, but in the case of the logic actions, there's a better way to deal with it. You can actually understand what these topologies are. So if we have L as a language and F is a fragment of infinitary logic, so that means a countable fragment of infinitary logic. So that means a collection of infinitary formulas closed under not and quantifiers and subformulas. Okay, this is the language. You got your symbols, you know, relation and function symbols. You build formulas, and you're allowed to have infinitary conjunctions and disjunctions, but only finite strings of quantifiers. Now, the smallest fragment is ordinary finitary logic, but if you throw in a few infinitary formulas and close it, you get a fragment. Okay, now, if sigma is an L omega 1 omega sentence, I can define mod, sigma in k variables is an L omega 1 omega sentence, I can divide mod sigma n1 to nk, these are integers, is all x in XL, such that the structure encoded by x is a model of the sentence sigma when I plug in these numbers for the variables. Okay, and if we take the topology on XL with basis mod sigma n1 nk sigma in the fragment ni's in the natural numbers, this is a Polish topology, and the logic action is continuous. Now, by a theorem of Lopez-Escobar, the invariant Borel sets are precisely those sets defined by an L omega 1 omega sentence. So you take a fragment containing that sentence, and this gives us a finer topology satisfying all the results in this theorem. So in some sense, that theorem is older than this. This is kind of the generalization from infinitary logic to Polish group actions of an old theorem. Now, in writing this, I was sort of implicitly assuming everybody here is familiar with infinitary logic. That may not be true, so feel free to ask questions or look in my book. Right. Finite strings of quantifiers. Okay. Now, you remember also there was an analog of 1.5. If Y is analytic, then B, instead of being Polish, would be Strong-Chauquet. Well, that also holds. 4.5. You replace Borel. By sigma 1,1, and replace condition A by T is second countable Strong-Chauquet. So we have two G spaces, X, A, Y, B. This is the same G. So two different actions. An isomorphism, or a G space isomorphism, it's just what you think it is a bijection pi such that pi of g dot x equals g dot pi of x, except the dots are ambiguous. We're using two different actions. So let me write it pi of a g x is B of G pi of X. That's just what you think. Renaming the point. No. Okay. This is a G space isomorphism. We could also talk about a continuous or a Borel isomorphism, assuming there are topologies around. Okay, now theorem 4.6 says there's a universal action. And there's one big action by G, such that every action by G is isomorphic to the restriction of this action. Theorem 4.6, for every Polish G, there exists a Polish G space UG. So in other words, there's a continuous action A, such that for every Borel G space X, there is a Borel subset B, a Borel invariant subset B of the universal space, such that X is Borel isomorphic to UG, or A restricted to UG. B. Here's UG, and you got a bunch of orbits, and you restrict it to some B. Sorry about the scratching on the board there. Okay, so there's this one big space that contains all the little ones. Now, this is really a Borel theoretic result, not a topological one. So this is really a descriptive set theory class, not a topology class. The topological analog is false. As it's not true that every Polish G, we can't get one universal in the sense that every Polish G space is continuously isomorphic. It will be Borel isomorphic, but not topologically isomorphic. Okay, and again, it's a little more concrete with the logic actions. If we consider this, every group has a universal space. If we take the group S infinity, so the logic action for L is a universal S infinity space, if and only if L has symbols of unbounded arity. If the arity is bounded, then it's not universal, even strictly algebraic. You know, forgetting the Borel part, you just don't have enough action. Well, perhaps I should have said something else. By a Cantor-Bernstein type argument, any two universal spaces are Borel isomorphic. So we can talk about the universal space. Okay, now a corollary. A Borel measurable action is Borel isomorphic. Rephrase that. A Borel G space is Borel isomorphic to a Polish G space. And this is 4-4 and 4-6. And as I take any Borel measurable action on a Borel set by this theorem, that's the restriction of a continuous universal action. But the previous theorem says I can change the topology to make that Borel set. It's restricted to Polish. So Borel measurable actions on Borel sets are in some sense the same thing as continuous actions. And as I mentioned earlier, there's some theorems which are interesting independent of the equivalence relation. Well, even if you've got a transitive action with one class, that's not a very interesting equivalence relation, but this still has content. And it has some other content, too. For example, it follows that the stabilizer subgroup must be closed in a continuous action, that's obvious. So it must be true here that the stabilizer subgroup is closed. Okay. Now, at last, let's get to the equivalence relations, unless there's questions on this. Okay, so new topic. We have the orbit equivalence relation. And it's clearly sigma 1-1. And two things are equivalent, just means there exists an element of the group that moves one to the other. Okay, so all the results from last week about sigma 1-1 equivalence relations are applicable to orbit equivalence relations. It's not, in general, Borel. The equivalence relation is not, in general, Borel. And one way to see this, in fact, it may violate a theorem about Borel equivalence relations. It may violate theorem 3.7, which is the Glim-Ephros dichotomy. Or the second dichotomy, the theorem that says a Borel equivalence relation either is smooth, that is, it has a Borel separating family, or it's got a copy of E0. Let me give an example of that. Something. And of course it would follow from that that it's not Borel, not a Borel equivalence relation. Let's let L as the language of groups, and we'll let T be the theory of abelian P groups. Where P is a fixed prime. Okay, a P group means every element has order P to the n for some n. Okay, and we'll consider the logic action restricted to the G delta set. Mod T, not mod T. Okay, now these P groups are determined by what are known as the Ohm invariants. So roughly speaking, to cheat a little, there's a P groups correspond to an ordinal alpha less than omega 1 and a function f from omega 1 into omega, from alpha into omega. So you got an ordinal length sequence of integers. Those are the Ohm invariants. those of you who know more details, hold it against me for getting this not quite right. It's close enough to being right. Now, you can't have a countable separating family because you're getting a copy of Aleph 1. Think of just a string of, well, okay, Alpha goes to Omega, Union, Infinity. How about that? Think of a string of infinities of arbitrary length. You've got the sequence of Aleph 1 P groups. And but you can't have E0, you can't have an ergodic measure because you've got omega 1 separating families. You have a separating family of omega 1 measurable sets. So doing a little bit of measure theory, and you conclude that if you had an ergodic measure, it would have to be constant. So it doesn't contain E0. It doesn't have a countable separating family. This violates the Glim-Ephros dichotomy. It's kind of a canonical example of something that violates it. Okay, now as I said, it's not in general Borel. A continuous action by a locally compact group is easily F sigma, has an F sigma equivalence relation. Just a little compactness argument will get you that. So applying this theorem, or the corollary, continuous Borel actions by locally compact groups do have Borel equivalence relations. Now the general case is much more complicated if you want to consider the equivalence relation. Okay, now we've seen from this example that you can violate the Glim-Ephros dichotomy, and the reason I gave for violating it is you can pick out a collection of Aleph 1 orbits, which you wouldn't be able to do if there's in a definable way without using choice if you had a countable separating family. Now, it's an open question whether that's the only obstacle. Okay, now, any definable set of Aleph 1 orbits would be sigma 1, 2. For example, projective determinacy implies any projective set of Aleph 1 orbits is sigma 1, 2. So here is open. In any Polish G-space, at least one of the following holds. Holds for the orbit equivalence relation. May be smooth, maybe contains E0, so that's the Glim-Ephros dichotomy, or a third possibility is there is a definable or equivalently a sigma 1-2 set of Aleph 1 not perfectly many orbits. And if CH is false, you can remove this and just say there's a sigma 1-2 set of Aleph 1 orbits. Now, obviously, using the axiom of choice, you can pick out Aleph 1 orbits, but the claim is, well, there's no easy way to do it. Okay, well, that's we know that the second dichotomy theorem fails. What about the first dichotomy theorem, Silver's theorem? Now, we know Silver's theorem fails for arbitrary sigma 1-1 equivalence relations, but maybe it holds for the particular kind of sigma 1-1 equivalence relations, which are orbit equivalence relations. Well, at least until recently, there was something called the topological Vogt conjecture. Any Polish G-space contains countably many or perfectly many orbits. In other words, we knew there was a counterexample to the second dichotomy, but we didn't know there was one to the first. And about 6 months ago, I think many people would have said this is the most important open problem in the field. If you read the poster out on the bulletin board there about the workshop that mentions the topological Vogt conjecture, the web page mentions it. It was a big problem. And incidentally, the reason for the name is that this, by one of these theorems about changing the topology, if this is true, it's also true when you restrict attention to a Borel set of orbits. And therefore, it's true for the logic action, and therefore it implies the model theoretic Vogt conjecture restricted to models of an L omega, 1 omega sentence. So this is stronger than the Vogt conjecture, and it was a big deal 6 months ago. But mathematics progresses, and the result is that today we know less than we did 6 months ago. 6 months ago, we knew this was an open question. Now we don't know if it's open or solved. But there's a guy by the name of Robin Knight who claims to have a counterexample to the model theoretic Vogt conjecture and therefore the topological Vogt conjecture. It's 125 pages in print, one counterexample. And apparently, there's at most one person who understands it. So maybe one of the things we should do in this seminar is get somebody to read that 125-page counterexample and either vouch for its correctness or find the mistake. I guess that's what we have graduate students for. Okay, so let me tell you what's known. Theorem 4.8, so part A, which is due to Hjorth, says that if, let's call G big if there is a continuous homomorphism from a closed subgroup of G onto S infinity, otherwise small. And let's note that CLI groups are small because of the closure properties. Okay, so the class of small groups is bigger than the class of CLI groups. Okay, theorem 4.8a, which is due to Hjorth, small groups satisfy the topological Vogt conjecture. And maybe there's a theorem of Knight, which says S infinity violates it, from which it would follow by some general arguments that big groups violate it. So assuming Knight's counterexample is actually correct, and I certainly don't vouch for it. I have no reason to believe it's wrong, but I don't vouch for it. Assuming this is correct, we know exactly which groups satisfy the silver dichotomy. Those that are small satisfy it, and in fact the restriction to a definable set satisfies it, and others don't. Well, what about the second, the Glim-Ephros dichotomy? Theorem 4.9, CLI groups satisfy the Glim-Ephros dichotomy, the second dichotomy theorem. Part A. Part B, big groups violate it. By this example, or by Knight's example for that matter. And for all other groups, it's open. Yeah. 4.7. Missouri 4.7. The corollary is 4.7. Thank you. Okay, let me conclude with a couple of theorems about the equivalence relation and beyond these dichotomies. I guess I shouldn't have called part C a theorem. That's an open question. Okay, now we know it's not Borel in general. Here's a theorem 4.10. It decomposes into Borel pieces, so let's let X be a Borel G space. There is a function f such that for all alpha f inverse of the interval from 0 to alpha, I guess that's the same thing as alpha for, you know, von Neumann ordinal, is Borel and invariant. For all alpha less than omega 1, the orbit equivalence relation E alpha restricted to F inverse of 0 alpha is a Borel equivalence relation. And the associated Prewell ordering of X, you know, according to what ordinal you map it to, is delta 1, 2 And for the cognizant, the provably delta 1-2 are C measurable and therefore universally measurable and has the Bayer property. That's a nice pretty well ordering. So what am I saying here? You've got this G space X, and there's an orbit equivalence relation on X, and I can define, break it up into omega 1 pieces, and the restriction to each piece is going to be Borel equivalence relation, but the whole thing is not Borel. Okay, now again, for the logic actions, we can let F of X is the Scott height of the structure encoded by X. If you bound the Scott height, it's a Borel equivalence relation. So this can be viewed as kind of a generalization of that. Corollary 411 in a Borel G space, all orbits are Borel. Okay, now on the homework problems I assigned last time, or maybe, yeah, last time, the problem was to show there's a sigma 1-1 equivalence relation, which has the property that no orbits are Borel. So you see, it's certainly true that we cannot get an arbitrary sigma 1-1 equivalence relation as an orbit equivalence relation. Okay, so the question is, what can you get? And here's a vague question. Characterize those sigma 1-1 or Borel equivalence relations which are, literally are, or perhaps are up to mutual Borel reducibility, the orbit equivalence relation of a Borel action by a Polish group. Now, last Friday at the seminar, I gave Menachem a hard time for asking a vague question, so I feel obligated to give a precise version of this. And that'll be the end of the mathematics, although I have a few announcements. So here's an equivalence relation, I1, on, well, let's say on 2 to the omega to the omega, X, E1, an analog of E0. X, E1, Y means for all M, means there exists an M for all N greater than M, X, M, XN equals YN. So instead of sequences of integers that agree at finitely many coordinates, we got sequences of reals that agree on all but finitely many coordinates. And now here's a fact. E1 is not Borel reducible to an orbit equivalence relation. It's a pretty simple Borel equivalence relation. But not reducible to a Borel equivalence relation. Okay, so here's a precise question. I'll state it as a conjecture. It's open. Let's let E be a Borel equivalence relation. Either E1 is Borel reducible to E, or E is Borel reducible to an orbit equivalence relation. Okay, well, I think that's, yeah, go ahead, Stefan. Well, if the equivalence relation is not Borel, this will be false, right? You've got to break it up into pieces such that the equivalence relation is always Borel. Yes. Yeah, you can break it up into Borel pieces. It's the analog of bounding the Scott rank. Other mathematical questions? Okay, I just got a couple non-mathematical remarks about the organization of the course. First of all, there's no class next week because of the workshop. So the next class will be 2 weeks from today, which is October 15th. Okay, the fourth homework of the course is as follows. Go to some of the talks. At the workshop. I won't assign anything else because I don't want to compete with it. Now, the third homework at the top of the page, it says due October 8th. We don't have a class October 8th. That doesn't matter. Make sure Henrik gets it by October 8th and put it in his mail folder, but otherwise, no problem. Second homework is due today. You can turn it in just before you go, and your first homework is graded, so you can get it today. Now, we're going to have a change in the form of the course. The first four courses were preparation for the workshop, which means I was trying to cram the maximum amount of material in the 4 days without proving anything. That should change. Maybe it should have changed 4 weeks ago, but anyway, it will change now. So after the workshop, these classes will be more like ordinary seminars where we actually prove things. And it's basically up to you what we could do. We could certainly spend the rest of the semester proving the results I've stated without proof, or some of the other things that come up in the workshop, or perhaps talk about the homework. And now there's a reason that it's going to be up to you to decide what we're going to do, and that's because you're the ones who are giving the talks, not me. When I agreed to do this, part of the deal was I didn't have to work very hard. So I'm just the organizer, not the teacher. And no doubt I'll give some of the talks after the workshop, but not all of them. So if there's anybody here who would like to give a talk at this class or seminar about any subject connected to equivalence relations and group actions, see me and you can give a talk. And as for students who are enrolled here for credit, you're going to have to give a talk, at least one. You can talk any day you want, or as any Tuesday you want, and on any subject you want. I'll let you pick the subject. If you don't want to pick the subject, come talk to me and we'll make some arrangement. But we'll find something for you to talk about, but you should give a talk. Okay, that's it. Sorry I'm 10 minutes over.
Isn't there an official Polish group, one into which everyone else is embeddable, as assumptions subgroup, not too complicated?
As a closed subgroup.
As a closed subgroup?
Yes, the group of homeomorphisms of the Hilbert cube.
Okay. I'll tell you what I'm asking. I mean, this is going to get interested in the following. And compatibility with group G and an object X. Now, this is bi-embeddable into G2, X2, and X1 sits inside X2.
Right.
And G2 is and G2 can be actually lifted to the setwise stabilizer of X1 and G2. That means any G1 permutation on X1 extends to a G2 permutation on X2.
Uh-huh.
And you can choose the extensions in a way that an extension of X and an extension of Y, their composition.
Oh, okay. So there's no fixed action, just the group in this. And you're saying any action?
No. G1, X, and X.
So you're saying this fixed action extends to this fixed action.
But with when you lift, with a lifting. So so one thing is for all G and G1, there exists G hat and G2. Such that, okay, there exists just this embedding. So just view this as a subset, okay? There exists a set such that G1 is G2 restricted to X1. This is demand one.
Okay.
And the other is G1 G2 hat is G1 hat G2 hat. That means you chose, you lifted.
I think this is the theorem you want. There's a guy, actually he's in Israel, his name used to be Megrelishvili, it's now Levy, he's at Bar Ilan.
Okay.
Anyway, the theorem is this, you've got the group of permutation of homeomorphisms of the Hilbert cube acting on the Hilbert cube in the obvious way.
Okay.
Okay, take any Polish group, any action by that group on any Borel action on a standard Borel space, well, you might as well embed that into an action on a continuous action on a compact space. But anyway,
right.
The point is that there is an embedding of that group as a closed subgroup of the such that the restriction of that action on the Hilbert cube is the original action.
No, but the restriction on the whole Hilbert cube, you have homeomorphisms of the Hilbert cube.
Yeah, right. Okay, so let's call this H, which is the group of homeomorphisms of the Hilbert cube.
Yeah.
Okay, and any Polish group is a closed subgroup of this.
Sure.
Okay, so this acts on the Hilbert cube.
Sure.
Okay, now, given an action, G, Borel on a standard Borel space, I can find an embedding. I can represent G as a closed. I can find a G prime as a closed
subgroup of H.
Right, closed subgroup of H.
Yes.
And this, let's call this the evaluation action. And we look at the evaluation action restricted to G prime. And I'm claiming the G is, that this G is topologically isomorphic to G prime, and this action is isomorphic to this action.
Mm-hmm.
To a subset. I gotta take a subset of a subset.
Okay.
Yeah. Something stronger.
And there's some other
Okay. Oops, I should have turned this off.